Hello and welcome back to the Blockchain.com podcast. My name is Garrick Heilman. I'm the head of research at Blockchain.com and a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. One of the most common questions we receive at Blockchain.com is where can people go to find reliable data and information? Now, at Blockchain.com, we do our best to help with this through our various communication channels. For example, on our blog, we have an intro to crypto with links to great articles, movies, podcasts, and books about Bitcoin. And each and every month, we publish a monthly outlook, which contains, at the bottom, links to what we're reading and listening to. We also feature information on the blockchain.com website and our learning portal and our FAQs. But no single institution can cover everything in crypto, and not everyone can come to the London School of Economics to learn about crypto. The role of introducing the world of Bitcoin has largely fallen to the media and increasingly social media. Both are incredibly important to the vast majority of people interested in learning about Bitcoin. To discuss the role of the media vis-a-vis Bitcoin, I recently spoke with Natalie Brunel, a former broadcast journalist and host of the popular Coin Stories podcast. Natalie and I discuss what things the media gets right and wrong about Bitcoin, who are some people she recommends following on crypto Twitter, and which country Natalie thinks will follow El Salvador become the next nation to officially adopt Bitcoin. Well, Natalie, welcome to the Blockchain.com podcast. We have a standard opening question we always ask all our guests. How did you earn your first dollar or other form of currency?
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. Actual dollar? Like, what was my first job? Or do you mean Bitcoin?
Well, I'd love to hear both, actually. Yeah, we like to hear people's like early childhood stories about selling lemonade or whatever it was they did to you know, earn a euro or dollar or and yeah. Then, of course, we want to hear about Bitcoin as well.
So I was living in the suburbs of Chicago, and I was recruited by one of those, you know, modeling people that approach you at the mall. And my first job was being a hair model for a company called Sexy Hair.
Whoa.
Yeah, I think I still have that paycheck somewhere in my family's basement. But that was my first job. I was a hair model.
Wow. So people literally do just walk up to people in the mall and pitch them on doing modeling and sexy hair.
Oh, I have no idea too. They would approach us for those conventions, those acting conventions. I would beg my mom, please let me go to Hollywood. And she'd be like, no, this is a scam.
Awesome. And how did you earn your first Bitcoin as well?
So I purchased my first fraction of a Bitcoin in 2017 when I heard about it living up in Northern California. I had friends in the San Francisco area. A friend of a friend worked for Coinbase at the time. I heard about it, didn't understand it, was extremely skeptical, but very curious, saw a lot of potential. So I slowly started to dip my toes in, and I'm obviously very glad I did. I started to accumulate at that point and sort of go down the rabbit hole. And man, if I could just talk to myself back then, I would have bought a whole bunch more.
Yeah. Well, that's great that you got to hear about it back then and in 2017. You know, it raises this kind of question of, it comes up, I think, for a lot of people around Bitcoin, like, you know, am I late to Bitcoin? I think a lot of people, even back in 2017, were feeling like, oh, I've missed this. I'm so late. What do you think about that whole kind of debate about being early, being late, and how people should feel about it today?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's disappointing to hear people who think it is too late right now. I understand that the price is high, but there's still so much growth potential and we have so much adoption to go. I mean, I know that people are predicting 1 billion users in the next couple of years, and this is all adopting faster than the internet. And so if you think about, you know, just how we've penetrated the market so far, we only have what, like 2% of the world population exposed to Bitcoin. I know that some statistics came out yesterday from Grayscale about maybe like 67 million Americans having Bitcoin in some capacity, but it truly is early. If 2% of the world has Bitcoin and it's only, you know, $50,000 to $60,000, imagine what it could be if we were at 10, 20, 30% of the global population. So I do think it's still really early. But of course, I mean, knowing that people got Bitcoin when it was $10 or $100, it's frustrating, right? Like, you wish you could go back in time. But I just think it's the alternative is basically sitting on the sidelines and not getting in. And we don't want that situation. So I think it's still early and you kind of get Bitcoin at the price you deserve, right? I got it at the price I deserved.
Yeah, absolutely. And there certainly is, I think, a lot less risk today with stepping into the Bitcoin space than there was back in 2017 when you got involved, and certainly even earlier than that. But let's actually, let's step back a bit and kind of hear more about your background and what you did prior to discovering Bitcoin, and also what you're doing currently.
Yeah, sure. So I come from the media industry. I was a broadcast journalist and a network correspondent for more than a decade. I studied journalism in both undergrad as well as grad school, and I set off on this path working my way up the different television markets to become an investigative correspondent and an anchor. And, you know, I think it really ultimately led me down this path where I was predisposed to really valuing what Bitcoin offers and the problem that it solves, because for 10 years, I was basically on the front lines of some of the biggest problems facing society, from, you know, increasing crime and ballooning poverty and wealth inequality. And until I learned about Bitcoin, number one, I really didn't connect the dots and understand how all of it was related to how broken our monetary system was. But number two, I didn't have hope. I was really kind of getting to that point, especially in the last couple of years, where I felt sort of jaded. You know, the country was getting more and more divided. And every single year, no matter who came into office, whether it was red or blue, it seemed like the problems were just getting bigger and bigger. And Bitcoin really, when I learned about it, when I learned what the problem was and learned that there was a possible life raft, it really gave me hope. And my generation, the millennials, we need hope because we've really been crushed financially. I graduated into a recession. I'm now spending my 30s in another, you know, global financial crisis. And I'm really excited about what Bitcoin offers. And I think that we really, it's time to get out of the debt spiral that we're in, not just in the US, but on a global level.
Yeah, no, I've heard that from so many people that Bitcoin does offer some hope, something you can do to try to, like, you know, address how you're feeling about, you know, this just like treadmill, you know, of trying to get ahead financially, to save and you know, vote with your dollars in some way, you know, almost a protest vote about, you know, certain things that are happening in society. And you know, it's great to hear that kind of was a key part of what interested you in Bitcoin. So we've had a couple conversations with folks in the media on this podcast, and I think it's always interesting to talk with people who have a media background about the Bitcoin space and how the media covers it, and what are some of the things the media has done well, not so well. I've spent just an incredible amount of my time since I first started working full-time in the Bitcoin arena in 2013, talking with journalists and working with the media. Actually, my first job in crypto full-time was at CoinDesk back in 2013. And so I've spent a heck of a lot of time explaining this thing called Bitcoin, trying to kind of talk about some of the more controversial aspects, some of the more positive aspects. And just what's your kind of overall view of the media coverage of Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think we definitely have a lot of work to go in terms of educating the mainstream media. I get really disappointed when I see headlines that are misleading or they latch on to sort of sensational false narratives, like, for example, the energy arguments. And I would really like to see people that are in the space that I come from actually take the time to do their homework before putting out these headlines and articles. I just think it's really incumbent upon journalists to not just take what the government says at face value, to really hold their feet to the fire, hold them more accountable, and listen to the people who are taking a monetary technology and trying to change some fundamental things that are broken in our society. I think that, again, it's just there needs to be more education. I really respect the reporters that are doing that work. And I'm glad that obviously Bitcoin is now, there's a ticker for it, right, on CNBC. And I've had the chance to go on some programs and discuss it, which I'm really grateful for. But it's very, you know, few and far between that you see it on actual mainstream outlets like the Today Show or, you know, Good Morning America. I would like to see it get there. I would like to help use my skills and my background to help it get there. Because I think that it's something that everyone should know about. It shouldn't just be, you know, a word that they hear that's maybe trendy or people are kind of hearing it in passing. I really want people to dig into how this can fix problems, how technology can fix some of the biggest problems in society. So we have some work to go.
No, absolutely. 100% agree. And sometimes like I sit there and like, I've been spending 8 years working with journalists and still, yes. Have we accomplished anything? I sometimes wonder to myself when I see certain headlines come across. One of the things that early on, like certain media organizations, they'd bring people like me in for some media training on crypto and they were aware of the fact that this image that is often used on television in you know, articles published online of physical, you know, kind of goldish colored Bitcoins that accompanies any story about Bitcoin. They're aware that this actually is kind of problematic because, of course, Bitcoin is digital. It's not physical. And yet almost every time you see a story appear on TV or in, you know, an online article, it has this kind of physical coin image. And the kind mm-hmm. of confusion that that creates for, you know, someone who already has a hard time understanding what money is and where money comes from, and they're trying to now figure out this thing called Bitcoin. And mm-hmm. I was just wondering, have you come across that issue and thought about that? And is there a better image that the media should be using when they do a story on Bitcoin?
I mean, I think that's an interesting point. I haven't really thought about it a lot before, but I definitely think that they should get a little bit more creative to sort of encapsulate and illustrate the idea of something being completely metaphysical and ushering us into this sort of digital age of saving. But, you know, to be honest with you, based on my experience in the media, especially television, our viewers were predominantly older. They were not my peer group. They were not the millennials and the younger generations. And I think that maybe that physical, you know, importance is it's predominantly more with older generations that maybe watch television and legacy forms of media. They take a little bit longer, I think, to adopt millennial technology. We certainly saw it with Facebook, but, you know, they came around. I think they'll come around on Bitcoin too. But I do think it's also funny that there was actually physical coins. I don't know if you probably are familiar with Cassatius coins. I heard about them from one of my podcast guests, Dan Held, who was in Bitcoin very, very early. And in about 2013, he was given a physical coin, a physical gold coin that had the Bitcoin logo on it. And then in the back, it gave you your key, and you could obtain, you know, you could access your Bitcoin from that physical coin. And I guess they discontinued them, but literally he got paid back for a couple of drinks that he bought his friend, a couple of beers, and he was given these Cassatius coins, which were physical, which is kind of funny to think about. But no, I mean, that image hasn't bothered me, but they could also get a little bit more creative, I think.
I'm glad you mentioned the physical coin history. I think I have one here called like a denarium. I think it didn't quite achieve the same level of notoriety or circulation as the Cassatius coins. But yeah, I think that's literally like a picture of these things is maybe what the media has been using all these years.
Yeah.
And it's just as an educator, and I feel like the media is in the education business as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we really try to, you know, think about how can we reach and explain this to, you know, as many people as possible. Yeah. And trying to make something, you know, I think that is complicated, like Bitcoin, you know, easier to grasp. We reach for these physical representations, these metaphors, to tell these stories about what this is and try to help people kind of like, you know, figure this whole thing out. How do you like to explain Bitcoin to someone who's totally new to Bitcoin?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, just to touch on what you said, I think it's really interesting to think about when technologies emerge, and so, and how people are sort of skeptical, and how we go from a place where maybe we want to dissect everything and criticize it, or say maybe we're not even going to use it. And then all of a sudden we go to a place where it's ubiquitous and everyone does. And what I mean by that is, back when the internet came out in the 90s, you had people on places like the Today Show saying, I don't think I'm going to use it. What is this @ symbol? What's .com? And they look pretty silly now, right? Because every company is basically a digital company, and everyone has their identity and personality, and they exchange value online. And I'm sure, you know, when the first cars came out, people scratched their heads like, how does an engine work? But you don't really need to know all of the nuanced details and the programmatic, you know, scheme of Bitcoin in order to appreciate its use. Because I think while Bitcoin is extremely nuanced, it's also powerfully simple. It literally allows you to transact value in a matter of, you know, seconds or minutes across the world, and settles it without any third party or government or CEO. And so basically that's what I like to describe to people, you know, this world where I can send value, I can send monetary energy from wherever I am across the planet, and that person receives it, and there was no third party involved, and it's reinforced by this massive, powerful computer network that is as resilient as ever and allows anyone to access it at any time. It's an open source. It's literally the people's money. It's freedom money, in my opinion, and I think it's so exciting because we live in a time where our money supply is just expanding and expanding, and people don't understand how much it's hurting the people in the middle class and in the lower class. We don't have a concept, due to, I think, a lack of financial literacy education, that the money printing is hurting the very people that it's trying to, or it's claiming to help, right, by spending or sending out checks. We really need to return to a sound money, a sound economy based on value, based on real price signals, based on real interest rates. And I really think, you know, it might be lofty, but I really think Bitcoin can move us in that direction. And I see it as providing the, you know, ultimate property rights. And I truly, truly hope that more people start to learn about it and embrace it, because I think it's going to change our world.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing I would just add to what you said, you know, Jack Dorsey mentioned that one of the things that really struck him about Bitcoin, and especially people who are, you know, kind of struggling economically to make it, is how it really introduced a savings culture and a desire to save, a motivation to save, because of the appreciation of the scarcity, that this is something that's precious, that there is a limited supply of Bitcoin. And people are a little more reluctant to want to part with something that they know is valuable, that is scarce, and how it's helping, you know, some segments of society that have traditionally struggled to establish a savings culture, to build savings, which is absolutely critical to getting ahead in life. You have to figure out a way to save. Anyone listening, you've got to find a way. You got to tighten the belt. You got to cut your expenses. You cannot get ahead financially in life and make it unless you figure out a way to save. And Bitcoin was helping a lot of these folks, you know, motivating them to figure out ways to save.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think your message is so powerful and so important, especially in the debt economy that we live in. It's interesting to see sort of this evolution and as Bitcoin is adopted around the world, and how different it is in the US, I think, versus other countries. In other countries, it's really much more useful as a medium of exchange to transact daily, because they need it. They need it to subvert their oppressive government, or in order to avoid the crazy amounts of inflation that they're experiencing. Here, I think it's still primarily viewed as digital property and a digital store of value. And that savings technology aspect is, I think, so important, because most of my peers are in debt, mostly because of school. I was talking to a girlfriend that I went to grad school with just yesterday, and she has more than $100,000 of debt, and she's been paying. I mean, that's just like interest just keeps getting her behind, and the goalpost keeps moving, and she doesn't know when she'll be able to pay it off. We live in, you know, a totally credit-based system. And I think having something that we know, yes, it's volatile in the short term, but it's appreciating in a powerful way over the long term, that allows us to start to think about the future, drop our time preference, start to plan, and maybe accumulate some wealth so that we can actually afford the things that we want for our family someday. I think that's an incredible thing, because again, before Bitcoin, what direction were we going in? What was going to be the solution? Was it, I mean, I'm sure if we have a massive bust, which I like to sometimes, you know, debate and talk with people about, are we going to have a deflationary bust because we're in such a leveraged bubble right now, in my opinion. Well, would people have fled to gold if we didn't have Bitcoin? And gold obviously has, you know, a lot of physical obstacles, and it's cumbersome and it's not easy to transport. It's centralized in reserves. Now we have Bitcoin. We don't have to worry about some of that. And I truly think that more and more people will start to finally understand and grasp this, especially if we're going to get out of this massive amount of debt that we're in. It's really scary to think how we've borrowed from the future. And now I think we're starting to bear a lot of the consequences in the massive amount of inequality that we experience in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Just staying with kind of the personal financial kind of like theme for a moment, because it sounds like you talked to quite a few people who are coming into the space. And all of us, I mean, all of us have friends and family who are thinking about, you know, maybe stepping into the world of Bitcoin. How do you kind of advise people? And you don't need to plug the blockchain.com wallet or anything here. You can be completely honest with what advice you give to people about how to take the first steps into Bitcoin, like even how much to get in. I think some people feel this like, oh, I've got to go all in, you know, like it's either or, like, and I'm always like, no, you can start with some trivial amount of money to you. You know, if it got lost or if the price collapsed, it wouldn't really hurt you. Like, start there. But is that a good way to go? What do you tell people?
Yeah, I mean, I always remind people that whatever money they're putting in a traditional bank account is essentially earning negative interest rate at this point if you count inflation. So right now, you basically have to put your money somewhere. You have to risk it in a sense, or become, you know, a day trader on the side just to have value into the future. And so I like to say, if you're really conservative, you're really worried, put in disposable income that you would spend on, say, a coffee or something. You can start with as little as $1, $5, but just start. I think it's important to help people understand that idea of dollar cost averaging, DCAing, so they kind of take advantage of just any swing in the market, upside, downside. It doesn't matter. It'll all average out at the end of the year because you're just constantly accumulating and stacking. I always like to also remind people, this isn't a trading game. This is an accumulation game. This is about wealth accumulation and savings, like you mentioned. So I think that people should start with whatever amount of income that they would normally actually put in a traditional bank, so that they actually get value and show them the price charts of this is how much it's appreciated. I mean, Bitcoin is the best performing asset of the last decade. It's certainly far outperformed the biggest, most famous stocks, the S&P 500, definitely gold. And so I think a non-zero position is appropriate for everybody right now. And I understand that people are still worried about the volatility. Maybe they need to make a big purchase. But it's so exciting that Bitcoin right now, we're growing so much that there are lending products now. You can, you know, take out a loan against your Bitcoin. But again, I think DCAing to start is really important. But I also think that people need to understand, again, like what they're getting themselves into and why Bitcoin was created. Bitcoin wasn't created just for, you know, for fun to have digital cash. It was created with a very real purpose. The white paper talks about the problem with central banking. And so I think people should expose themselves a little bit to just the literature out there. And my personal favorite book is The Bitcoin Standard.
And I'm glad you brought up dollar cost averaging, because there's an interesting psychological, I think, benefit to taking a dollar cost average approach, where you kind of set up a program or a schedule whereby you say, okay, you know, you can even automate this through certain platforms where it happens automatically for you. But basically, you're going to buy some quantity of Bitcoin at a predetermined, you know, time and date, regardless of the price. And you just do that automatically. And one of the neat kind of psychological benefits of doing that is that when the price tumbles, as it can do, as it did on Friday, down 20%, and you happen to have your purchase timed around that price decline, you accumulate a greater nominal amount of Bitcoin. And so you can almost feel good about it, like, oh, I get even more Bitcoin. You know, and these little like psychological tricks, I think can be helpful for some folks. But it's a great way to kind of like almost, you know, insulate yourself a bit from some of the price volatility, where sometimes you pay a bit more, sometimes you may pay a little bit less. Yes. It averages out, as you said, and it really kind of removes, I think, this kind of like stress around trying to time, oh, yes, I didn't get it at the absolute low, or, oh, I paid so much. And it you know, you're on autopilot and you're relaxed, and it's just, your stash is growing.
Yeah. I love that set it and forget it aspect and mentality of Bitcoin, that you really don't have to worry about it if you are dollar cost averaging in. And I think that, you know, it's not very dissimilar from our 401k plans, right? You allocate a certain percentage of your paycheck, and every week the price is technically different of those shares of whatever index fund that you're in for whatever retirement year you chose. And, you know, you're going to capture different prices at different times. And it's very similar to that. And I think it's important to just start putting away money that, you know, will increase in value over the future compared to the US dollar, which the more that they print, unfortunately, it's just collapsing the power, which is so, so, so sad, because it really does hurt the people in the middle and at the bottom of our society the most.
Absolutely. So you're active on social media. What would you say about the state of crypto social media? Like, where are people going today to, you know, express their views about Bitcoin? How has the social media landscape for Bitcoin evolved since you first took an interest in this space? And if you were trying to explain crypto Twitter to a total newcomer, how would you guide them and advise them to use it? Would you tell them to stay away from it? Tell them to only follow these certain people and ignore these other folks? What's your advice to somebody who's like just wading into crypto Twitter and how they should even use it or view it?
Yeah, you know, I love this question, because I really didn't use Twitter until I got into Bitcoin and I started following the biggest thought leaders, and I wanted to interview them for my show. I started with, I think I had like 2,000 followers when I launched my Coin Stories podcast in May, right before the Bitcoin conference. And today I have more than 115,000 followers, which is just like, it boggles my mind. I don't know how that happened, but I think it goes to speak that there's such an appetite for information and for people who are putting out content in this space. And especially, there aren't a lot of women putting out content. So hopefully I'm bridging that divide a little bit and taking the skills that I use as a reporter and as a messenger and communicator to good use using Twitter. But, you know, I absolutely love the platform. Now I check it constantly, and it's where I get the majority of my headlines. I learn about fascinating articles to read, newsletters. I love following all the people that I've interviewed, and even people that are, you know, kind of curious or new to the space, and hearing their questions and what do they really want to know about this asset. So crypto Twitter, I mean, I pretty much use Bitcoin Twitter. I don't really engage with a lot of people in the online space, or they don't engage with me because they know I'm super into Bitcoin. But I just think it's an amazing source for information. I think, you know, Safe recently, when Jack Dorsey announced that he was stepping down from Twitter, Safe Anita Moose, who wrote the Bitcoin Standard, my favorite book, put out this tweet that, you know, it transformed his career. It gave him a voice. And it's really done the same for me. And so I love Twitter. I'm a little bit anxious and nervous about what's going to happen with new leadership and whether that's going to affect the app at all. But I just think it's a brilliant platform for being able to share and engage with Bitcoin-related content. And, you know, I think that people, if they're just getting in, to just start following the hashtags, because most people hashtag either Bitcoin or crypto, and they can start to follow some of the bigger people in the space, see who they relate to. And I just think it's great. I love Bitcoin Twitter.
Cool. And do you want to give a shout out to any other people who you've learned a lot from, or you think are particularly useful to follow? Like, who should be the first like three follows?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, there's so many. Michael Saylor, legend, amazing. And I think he does one of the best jobs orange pilling people when he goes on shows and interviews. He's just so well spoken and speaks in really relatable metaphors. Lynn Alden, for this macro, brilliant macro perspective. I think she's absolutely phenomenal. She's one of my favorite people. I get her Twitter alerts whenever she tweets. Preston Pish, Dan Held, Anthony Pompliano, the Kaisers, Max and Stacy. I mean, there's so many people. I've just loved this whole space, because they're not only brilliant and successful, but they're really relatable and nice and approachable. And so I'm super grateful to learn from them.
Cool. And do you see, I'm glad you mentioned, Jack's departure as CEO from Twitter and some worries about what that means for the future of Twitter as kind of, a primary social media platform for Bitcoin. Can you kind of dig into that a bit more? And, I know that there's talk of trying to decentralize Twitter and moving it to a more decentralized protocol. It seems Bitcoin's pretty well embedded in Twitter's DNA at this point. But you think there is a reason to worry about that changing?
I don't know. I'm not a super big expert on the infrastructure behind Twitter, but I do remember that when Jack Dorsey stepped down, there were some people sharing basically like a November 2020 interview with the person who's taking his position, and I'm blanking on his name right now, but basically where he was talking about how Twitter's essentially not a place where we're in the career to defend freedom of speech or something. I forgot what the quote said, but basically I have concerns that there is potentially the chance for more censorship. I don't think it was Jack Dorsey who would ever advocate for people to be removed from Twitter. I think he's a really big proponent of freedom and freedom of speech. And so I'm curious what will happen as Twitter evolves. I've already seen small changes. Like now, basically, you have to have permission from everyone that's within a picture if you post it, which I'm not sure if that's going to lead to some, really interesting things. I just worry. I mean, technology is quickly evolving, and I've personally seen, obviously the congressional hearings related to Facebook and just situations where the leadership tends to defend the government as opposed to almost the people and the freedom to communicate freely. And I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not an expert at, again, at Twitter, but I just hope that we don't move in a direction of censorship.
Right. I want to speak with you about, I think, one of the biggest stories as we wind up the year of 2021, which was the decision by the first ever country, El Salvador, to make Bitcoin legal tender and to start to accumulate it as a reserve asset. And we've got the president on Twitter announcing when the dip has been bought. My big prediction at the end of last year in CoinDesk was that a country would come out and start doing what El Salvador has done and start accumulating it as a reserve asset. I thought it might be through sovereign wealth funds, and I certainly didn't expect a country to actually, prior to doing that, to embrace it as legal tender, to legalize it for settling debts and payments. I just wanted to get your impression about the whole El Salvador story. It's somewhat controversial. Some people have mixed feelings about what's happening there. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I'm very bullish about it. I think it's very progressive. I mean, at the end of the day, you can try to criticize President Nayib Bukele, but he basically allowed for a currency that he can never control the supply of, he can never manipulate, to be used as legal tender. And you have the choice to convert it back and forth. He gave everyone access to a wallet. What will happen with that wallet's success or adoption? Will it be used as a way to, track people's payments? That, I think, is still yet to be determined. But he's trying to promote innovation, as far as the mining element and really taking advantage of green energy, using their natural resources, using their volcano to power a system that could potentially build so much infrastructure and provide the country with wealth. I think that's amazing. The announcement about Bitcoin City, where there's going to be no property taxes, no capital gains tax, basically just a 10% flat sales tax, inviting everybody in to come innovate, live here, help us thrive. We'll help you thrive. I think it's amazing. And to see a millennial president engaging with people on Twitter, letting people know that he bought the dip on his phone, I mean, this is something I didn't expect to see in my life, but it's amazing. I was actually on on the Twitter spaces hosted by Nick Carter way back when they were voting on this. They were voting in real time, and we were on a Twitter spaces with more than 10,000 people listening to the cheers as like the vote came in, you know, and I thought this was incredible. I don't see Joe Biden or other presidents doing this, you know, getting on Twitter and engaging in real time with the public on something that it's a technology that could revolutionize our lives. So I think it's super exciting, very bullish on it. I'm actually just curious what country will be next.
And that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. I mean, there's been like various politicians in other parts of Latin America who have introduced legislation in their countries. I don't think any of those have gotten, you know, to the goal line quite yet. But, you know, Brazil and others have, I think, taken steps. I mean, I'm sure certainly lots of people are watching what's happening in El Salvador. Do you think it's going to be another Latin American country that would take this step next?
I actually think it's going to be Ukraine.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think it could be a Latin American country. I know it's being discussed, but I think that there is a lot of chatter right now happening in Ukraine. There's a lot of development in this space there. And so I think that maybe they could surprise us.
Well, I think you're right to point to Ukraine as a strong candidate. I think that they've had to disclose the level of Bitcoin ownership amongst politicians in Ukraine. And it's something like, I mean, I think it was like 50,000 or so Bitcoins maybe that were owned. I mean, I think there's one massive whale and a number of other people, but yeah. Ukraine consistently ranks as a country near the top of Bitcoin penetration. I think Chainalysis mm-hmm. did have Ukraine ranked at some point in time as number one. And certainly it's an interesting, as we look into the next year and kind of like try to peer into the crystal ball, I think one of the big questions I have is, you know, the geopolitical landscape seems very in flux. You know, you've got supposedly Russian troops massing on the Ukrainian border. You've got this diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics, or sorry, the Chinese Winter Olympics, and questions around Taiwan and what the geopolitical landscape and changes to it might mean for Bitcoin. And I think Ukraine is a really interesting case study. Because things have been topsy-turvy in Ukraine for you know a while now, and we've seen that country embrace Bitcoin in a way that a lot of other countries haven't. And to me, that seems to provide some evidence that geopolitical uncertainty is and can be a powerful driver of Bitcoin adoption.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, especially after the China ban, and see which countries potentially move to that step of legalizing it as tender. And, you know, absolutely, with regards to Ukraine, I sort of relate in the sense that I come from the Eastern Bloc. I come from a formerly communist country, Poland, very close by. And it's interesting to see them sort of fighting for this national identity and trying to break free from this oppression that they experienced for so long. And I think that Bitcoin is certainly something that probably their values align with, right? Because they know what it's like to live in those sort of dark ages of authoritarianism. And I truly believe that this technology will be embraced by more nation states. It's just, it might take some time. I know that people are waiting to have the next announcement, right? Every other week or the next month. It's going to take some time. I think some of it's going to come out of nowhere. And we're still early, like we kind of mentioned at the top of this interview.
We're starting to run out of time here, and I have to ask you about hanging out as I saw on social media with Mr. Goldfinger himself, Peter Schiff, recently it looked like, and everyone's favorite whipping boy, you know, on Bitcoin Twitter. Tell us about Peter in person. What's he like? Is he a good sport about all this? You know, harassing he gets through the years. He certainly dishes it out himself. And then also, I just would love to hear your thoughts on just gold. I mean, gold has been a massive disappointment for many people this year. It's down like 6 or 7% for the year in this inflationary environment. A lot of people are blaming Bitcoin for kind of breaking the back of gold. Should Bitcoiners be so anti-gold, or, you know, it's a two-part question.
Well, you know, it's funny. Gold was up, I think, 5% or something like that on the day of the dip, which is when I saw him in Miami during Art Basel. So he was kind of happy, right? He kind of nudged me. He's like, you know, gold's up, Bitcoin's crashing. And I'm like, oh, Peter, let's zoom out and let's see how gold performed. No, he was fantastic. I think actually Peter Schiff has done more for Bitcoin adoption than some of the biggest Bitcoiners. I think he's so amazing to have in the space. You know, I love Peter Schiff because he's such a brilliant historian and Austrian economist. He knows literally just the most fascinating details of how our monetary system evolved and how it works and the history of the Federal Reserve and some of the government programs that we've been funding for the last few decades. I mean, he truly can just spell out all of the history, which I'm fascinated about. And I think he secretly loves Bitcoin and secretly loves being this sort of, you know, villain in the space because he hangs out with Bitcoiners. I met him in an art show where his good friend had put together a Bitcoin painting and he was a big Bitcoiner and they hang out and they're super close. I also want to make a quick shout out. His wife is so beautiful, so sweet. Peter, really, you're out kicking your coverage there. but no, he was great, loved it. And I don't think it's about like Bitcoiners hating gold. I think it's about the fact that gold doesn't make sense when we have Bitcoin. So I think it's just about sharing that message and bringing people into sort of the technology version of gold that has so many more benefits and is much more easy to transact with than gold.
Yeah, that's great. Well, where, Natalie, can people go to learn more about you? And please feel free to tell us a bit more about your own podcast.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at Nat Brunel. I'm very active on that. And then my podcast is called Coin Stories. I should probably call it Bitcoin Stories because I pretty much talk to the biggest thought leaders within Bitcoin. But I do speak with contrarians, like, for example, Peter Schiff. He's been on a few times. But basically, I try to humanize the stories and get a little bit more on the backgrounds of the people that have huge followings and a lot of influence in the space. I like to know sort of where they come from, how their careers evolved, and why they really believe in Bitcoin, how they discovered it, and what aspects of it are they really passionate about that they would like to share, especially with newcomers. So I go through their whole backstory, and I've learned so much from them. And so I hope people check it out on all the podcast platforms as well as on YouTube.
Fantastic. Natalie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you're enjoying our podcast, please rate us and leave a review as it really helps boost our visibility to more listeners.